Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope this week, and another recurring guest from a previous Conversations Cafe panel that we get to spend some more quality one-on-one time with. But first, as always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. Our biggest announcement of the season will come this Friday, and you will not want to miss it, as well as with the launch of our blog series and our first blog posts. We are going to bring you excellent writing from past guests and friends of the show. The blog will be kicking off with a series titled Eureka, based on inspiration from one of my favorite Comic-Con artists, Monkey Minion Press, and their excellent art book titled Eureka, The Art of Science. Check them out on Instagram at Monkey Minion Press and their website at monkeyminionpress.com to get a head start. One little surprise we can let you all in on is to be on the lookout for a special Monday edition of Anthologies of Hope for November 11th, Veterans Day here in the United States. In partnership with Hope for the Day, we'll be bringing you some in-depth conversations with veterans of the American Armed Forces to discuss the mental health impacts of joining the military, serving both at home and abroad, as well as what mental health care is like once you return home. Later this month, keep an ear out for our new Mental Health Minute episodes as well. These shorter episodes will cover practical, research-proven tips on how you can approach your mental health care delivered in a conversational and actionable approach, starting with two separate episodes to focus on skills and techniques for anxiety and depression, respectively. These Mental Health Minute episodes will be accompanied with blog posts of their own, so you can take away concrete courses of action whenever you may need them. Our guest this week is someone whom you may have heard before on Anthologies of Hope during one of our Conversations Cafe panels. To be more specific, our first Conversations Cafe panel that we shared through Anthologies of Hope. Megan Tress joins us this week, and I am so excited to bring you this conversation as we dive deeper into all the things she touched on in her time on the All in the Family panel experience from our Season 1 bonus episode. I love how intertwined all of our interviews are becoming, with so many references and topical overlaps between them. As you'll recall from just a few weeks ago, Amanda Vetrano was on this very same panel, as well as going all the way back to day one with our very first episode and our talk of nursing and caregiver careers, where we were joined by Anna Johnson, who is now Anna Sturkey, since she has gotten married in the time that we talked to her, so congrats are in order. You will also hear many echoes of our more recent conversations with both Casey Ryan and Amanda Vetrano, calling out much of the similar stigmas, hurdles, and hardships that folks face when trying to get help of some sort for many different reasons. I'm grateful for Megan's passion in the fight for proactive mental health care and her determination to make a difference in the system that seems destined to be gridlocked for the everyday recipient. Megan brings a very keen insider's perspective to the conversation around mental health care, working at a provider, and how she addresses her professional career in contrast to and comparison with her personal mental health care needs as well. This is yet another week I'm very excited to bring you this conversation. Of course, as it is a new season, we will be starting a new Spotify playlist to join in with all of our long-form interviews. You can go check it out right now at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, and it has all the songs associated with the first half of Season 3 right now. You can still find Season 1 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-1-playlist, and Season 2 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-2-playlist. Every week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we'll be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Trait Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. Trait Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help, and Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, @gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, or wherever else you would like to see us. Please let us know. Make sure to check back in on Friday for our major announcement, one that has been at the top of my mind since we started Anthologies of Hope, as well as be on the lookout for the first couple of posts to our new blog, starting with the Eureka-inspired blog series. But in the meantime, sit back, relax, and to borrow a term from our friend Terry from Season 1, enjoy the sacred echoes of my conversation with Megan Tress. We're here with Megan Tress, and I want to say first thank you for calling or shouting out Anthologies of Hope on the first recorded Convo Cafe that we did back in January, recorded in November 2018, aired January 2019. So that was, it was fun going back to prep for our interview to go back and hear that was like the first thing out of your mouth for one of the responses. So that was fun. So I think also with that, you're the first, technically second or repeat guest that we've had, even based off of, yeah, since we haven't recorded any other episodes with anybody else at the moment, as far as that. So being a guest on Convo Cafe that we recorded and aired, and then now a episode all to yourself. So welcome.
Circling back around.
Exactly. So at the time we last heard from you on the episode or on the podcast, you were a nurse practitioner and you had some recent job changes, or so is that role changes as well, or what all happened there? Because at the time you said you had plans to infiltrate the healthcare system, so did that happen? Or
I think I probably did say that. Yeah, I
well so I have it the, in quotes here.
Yeah,
so.
and I when I was looking at that, I was thinking, when did I say that? But probably during that, because at the time I was working inpatient.
Okay.
More in the role of like a hospitalist, means you're admitted to the hospital for whatever the case may be, but not, I wasn't working in psych at the time, and I'm still not, but working, and a lot of people were coming in very ill, like to the point where, you know, they needed to be in the hospital, couldn't be managed outpatient, they were short of breath, they had an acute asthma exacerbation, or they have a really bad infection and needed IV antibiotics, but so often people were also having symptoms complicated by things that were going on in their personal lives, and a lot of times even diagnosed mental illnesses or non-diagnosed, but things that made it clear like that was their physical illness was a manifestation of them not being able to manage all of their medications, or they didn't have access to care and they're diabetic but they can't get any of their medications and they end up in the hospital, or they have an untreated mental illness and that definitely makes it difficult to take care of anything, so they end up in the hospital. Yep. And at the time I was feeling really frustrated because I felt like we weren't dealing with any of those issues. We were just kind of like sweeping them under the rug, or at least everyone on the team was, because it's really hard to deal with. And there's, even in the hospital, so few resources.
There's only so many times you can treat the symptom before you treat the cause of something, and you'll eventually run out of resources before taking it upstream.
But unfortunately, and I mean systemically, it's such a problem because we don't have the same providers seeing the same patients all the time. And there's no like organized electronic medical record. So I could be a person really struggling with mental illness, but also with a physical illness like diabetes. That's an easy one. I could go to every single hospital in Chicago and like no hospital would know that I was going to all these other hospitals. And so I think a lot of times you are just like treating that one thing without treating the root cause like over and over and over again. And it's so frustrating. It's frustrating for the patients too, especially if they're trying or they can't afford their medication, or, you know, no one's really stopped to listen to them. Yeah, it's really unfortunate. So anyways, at the time I was thinking like in that role, and I think I did impact some of the people I was working with and try to change the perception of people coming in also suffering from mental illness or a mental health challenge in some way that was impacting their and why they ended up in the hospital. Because I noticed when I started there, there were a lot of people just, because it feels so overwhelming, there were a lot of people just saying like, this person's crazy, or, you know, oh, you can take that person, you can deal with it. And sometimes up to the person, you know, verbalizing maybe suicidal ideation, maybe hallucinations, maybe very, you know, very typical behavior of someone with a diagnosed mental illness, like grandiose thinking or mania, but still they just like didn't want to deal with it. But I think even the way that I talked about it and just thinking like, hey, that person didn't choose that behavior, and if they had the means to cope differently, they would. Just in the same way that they wouldn't choose to have diabetes, they wouldn't choose that. And when I left that job, and I left it because I just kind of felt like this is not my calling to be in a place with people cycling that I can't see over and over again, and I can't really address the mental health stuff. Some of my coworkers said like, you know, I think about people in those positions coming in. I just think about it differently. And hopefully me not being there doesn't mean that they're not thinking that way anymore. But I think sometimes it was personalizing it too. Like, hey, like I've experienced this with my own family members and we're all like living on the edge of sanity all the time. You know, this could happen to any of us. And I worked in that job with a lot of women. And I feel like women in healthcare and specifically maybe women in nursing have a lot of awareness about postpartum depression or postpartum psychosis even. And so there's this awareness of like, oh yeah, I experienced that, or I had a friend that experienced that. And it's so real and it's so extreme. So if you can like give that acceptance and that like love to someone who you know, who like, again, didn't choose that, that it's something that happened chemically or naturally or for whatever reason, that if you could give that same like love and respect to a patient, it's only going to be constructive. It can't hurt anything for you to approach the situation that way.
On the Combo Cafe episode, you said you got into nursing because you felt helpless to care for your own family.
Yeah.
And so obviously like that is something that you want to make a difference for. So like you hope that the effort you're putting in, like there's some change coming out of that. It's not just going in and moving the pile of bricks from this side of the room to that side of the room and like clocking out at the end of the day. Like you hope to make a difference in people's lives when they come in because they need help. And if that's not working, I can definitely see that being a struggle to kind of keep showing up and just having it be the same thing over and over again. But when it's coming to people who aren't getting any better or who are getting technically worse, then it can definitely be a hard problem.
Yeah. So this recent job change that I made now since then was to an outpatient clinic that's in the community. It's working with a lot of people who have very limited resources and a lot of whom have experienced trauma, who have a lot of people who've recently moved here, a lot of kids who've experienced trauma. But really, I mean, I don't know that it's that unique to the setting that I'm working in, you know, if that's possible to understand. I mean, I think probably in any clinic and working with kids and adults from anywhere, like if you ask those questions beyond the first questions, like often I'll have someone come in for something that seems like, oh, I just like haven't been feeling very hungry recently, or I've been feeling nauseated a lot, and I eat and then I just don't feel very well. And then, you know, you ask all the questions to make sure that it's not anything like they don't have fevers, they don't, you know, all their vitals are fine. But then just a simple question of like, how's your stress level been, or what is your home life like? And then all of a sudden they start crying, you know? So it's just that like one question beyond, but it still feels really hard because that's not, I'm saying that and I'm talking to them and offering like an ear, but then it's also like, do they have the time to see a counselor? Do they have like, how much in their personal life is in their own control really? Mm-hmm. What's their age? How much do they have control over? And also the fact that it's not like this easy, like, oh, you come in with a sore throat and you test positive for strep and I give you amoxicillin. It's like you come in with these vague somatic symptoms. You tell me you have a lot of anxiety, you're very tearful, but then that's like a process and there's no one medication to give. So I've thought about that a lot with healthcare and providers. I think that's one of the reasons that people tend to choose fields of medicine. It's like some people want like instant gratification, you know, like people, surgeons, you know, like just cut things out,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Versus someone that has to deal or chooses to deal with something and maybe not progressing the way you want it to progress, or, you know, just being there and listening, even though you don't see progress all the time or in the way that you want to. In the way the patient wants.
In the end, it ends up being, if you're able to move them even towards that goal and kind of help them orient that and just understand that now, even just not necessarily even a diagnosis, but even an understanding of what they could be dealing with, of something like this, these could be anxiety related symptoms, these could be X, Y, and Z, and it's not just something that they're going through and feeling like their chest is going to explode from like tension or something like that. So once you rule out some of the physical elements, then understanding the mental impacts of that. And then it's just knowing that now there's like a whole other chapter of stuff that they can investigate and work on and move kind of their medical care into, as opposed to just resigning themselves to the fact that this is how they're going to feel or how they're supposed to feel, and know that it just feels like the world's crashing in on them and that just nobody knows that there's anything physically wrong with them. So you just got to suck it up and deal with it type thing.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people say, oh, I've never thought of it that way before. I never thought how that could impact me. One anecdote for that is with weight. People will come in and, you know, I disagree with how we handle weight in general in the medical field, but, you know, someone will come in because a previous provider said you need to follow up on your weight and like what kind of exercise are you doing? And, you know, there's these like eat a low cholesterol diet, eat high fiber, exercise for 60 minutes, 5 days a week. And I remember talking to someone who came in and he was like, man, they told me to make this follow-up appointment. Here I am. And then talking to him about some of his own anxiety around his weight and his own perception of himself and also the things that other people have said to him. And we talked for like a half an hour. I felt like we made more progress than just like telling him, oh, just come in again in 2 months and let's take, I mean, it's just, there's like nothing. Again, it's like shifting. How am I going to address this thing? Because obviously it's not working to do it this way. Just come in and we're not going to talk about anything else, you know, or like it happens with sleep too, or, you know, like anything.
Well, it's interesting that that conversation that you mentioned there, because I mean, I could have been at that appointment and it could have been in my sleep as a new father, as we were talking about before we started recording, but I just had physical yesterday for a new primary care doctor up this way. And it was kind of the same thing of going through of like just establishing care with a new, same practice, but just a new location, new all that stuff. And just getting in of like, okay, yeah, we have a newborn. I put on a ton of weight, not really sleeping, all this stuff. And she's like, okay, just like, that's understandable. Where I had providers in the past, it would have been like, yeah, you really need to get that down. You should do this and, you know, focus on this X, Y, Z. She's like, if you have an idea of what you need to do and stabilize, like it's not going to happen until you're getting better sleep. It's not going to happen until all your schedule kind of goes, stabilizes. And so she definitely had that conversation of knowing that's in context with everything else, as opposed to just like, just looking at a chart and be like, yeah, this has to get lower, and then be like, okay, do all this and see you later type thing. Yeah, and so it was a conversation, and it felt good that that wasn't like I failed a test and like had to go home and like get my paper signed by mom or something like that.
Yeah. And I remember when I was first getting into healthcare, there was a dentist that worked at the community health clinic that I was at. And he said, I feel like it's unfair to quote him, but I think he said, 80% of my job is customer service. And the only way that anyone will ever come back again to a dentist is if they feel good about the relationship they have with the dentist, you know, especially people who, you know, it's like a huge stretch to get to an appointment and maybe they've had really bad dental care in the past. And so then there's a lot of shame about showing up at the dentist and then you're going to just get shamed. Like it just makes no sense. It's not constructive at all to like address it that way and to shame people. And there's tons of research done on how little that does to address to motivate, weight in that way. Yeah. But that it was cool with that patient that I'm thinking of to just have him say, I just never thought about it that way, you know, and maybe there is a shift happening too. If you're having that experience, other people are having that experience that people aren't addressing it as like, this is a problem, this needs to get changed. But then again, our whole society is so data driven now that as the provider and depending on what kind of what kind of practice you're in and how you're compensated. Some places it's like, well, unless you meet these metrics that are just totally weird and arbitrary, then you're not going to bill the same or whatever, you know? But I think it's so important. And it gives that little window of time and addressing with that patient or with any patient, like, hey, maybe it's this other stuff going on. Maybe you moved from across country. You're the sole earner in this family of seven people. Like, think about how that's impacting you, and maybe that helps him to feel like, oh, like instead of feeling out of control, maybe more just more kind to yourself, you know, like, oh, there's reasons that this happened. Yeah. And it's not just because I don't care about my health or, you know, but also like with anyone, like kids that come in and you ask that, like you notice like some aggressive behavior or maybe they're really, really shy. And then you ask that question of like, how's your mood been? Or how do you feel? Or you give them like a standardized screening tool about, you know, asking questions of how often are you feeling down and how often you find yourself like not wanting to do things you used to want to do. And it's like all of those things are so prevalent. And then just to give them like a little chance to express those mm-hmm. feelings, it's like, oh, maybe you can change the framework of how they're seeing things and just being constructive.
Well, exactly. And that's what it all comes down to, is being constructive and kind of being a part of a whole and kind of just knowing that like you don't have to fit into the system or just kind of like subside and kind of do what everybody else is doing. Like if there's something for you that's not working in that system, then yeah, like you need to be able to take time to address it and take time to understand it and take time to talk about it. Some of what we had talked about at the Conversations Cafe that you were on, where again, addressing stigma, and then you have some of the self-stigma, and that's exactly what it is, where the kids don't even know that they're doing it, but then adults definitely do know that they're doing it, but they're like, I can't speak up because then like I'm different, or if I say I have this problem, but I don't have the solution, or I don't think I have an idea of what a solution could be, but I don't think I can handle it, or all of that stuff. So there's definitely a lot of self-stigma there, but just if you're working with a provider that gives you the opportunity to just have that conversation or have that space or have that time, that's paramount. And just having that and understanding it is going to, like in the long run, you would see a drop off in the need for a lot of the revolving door healthcare, because people would be able to take care of themselves better as opposed to just being a checkbox and then kind of keep moving people through. So obviously there's a lot there with the healthcare system in general that's going to have a problem with that. But as far as if it comes down to people and having that conversation with people, then just letting them know that there are other options or just like you said, the standardized screenings and kind of saying like everything's leaning this way. Like, did you ever think something like this could be a possibility? And then it's like a light flips on in their head and they understand there's these whole other reasons why they're feeling different ways and things like that. So that makes a lot of sense. With that, we can do some of a segue into some of the other stuff that we had talked about before. Usually we end up going through a little bit of a chronological journey, so we don't have to go through everything, and we don't definitely need to go up and down and through every trauma and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
You had said that you had got into nursing to help, or because you felt helpless to care for your own family. You had siblings and a parent who was diagnosed with mental illness. And then you had some substance abuse in your family history. And there's a lot going on there. So at like what age did you start to understand or realize that there was more to it, and kind of to the conversation we just had, that you were kind of starting to seek out therapy or other things to help with things that you knew weren't beneficial, or to kind of get outside of your own head or kind of break some of that stigma?
I think I mentioned in that Conversations Cafe that it was sort of a little bit of a mistake, but I was lucky that, because I do think parents often with their kids, I truly believe that most 99% of parents really want what's best for their kids, but it's really hard sometimes to know how to handle mm-hmm. things. And my parents had me when they were in their late 30s, but they had had their first two kids when they were in their early 20s. And so I was much younger and just didn't have a lot of like red flag warning signs that they thought were scary, you know. But at the time, I felt really obsessed with food and really obsessed with weight and really overwhelmed by school, even though I was doing well at school. And I think that's a common thing. Like when a kid is doing well at school, then there's no issues, you yep. know?
Yeah. I mean, I 100%, like if a kid, as someone who succeeded easily in school all the way into college, like if everything's right at school, like there's no problem whatsoever. Like,
right.
It's like, oh, keep going. Like you're doing fine. Type
right.
thing,
and so. Those are the questions that they ask at the yearly physical exams too. Like, how's it going in school? Or even now myself as an adult, I find myself asking that of kids, like, how's school? What's your favorite subject? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, that's the standard thing to ask. But I got really obsessed with food and was like asking my parents to take me to a nutritionist. And it was really the nutritionist that said like, hey, this is more than just eating. She had worked with the counselor that I then started seeing, and I really have great memories of working with that counselor because I really didn't know that I needed it, and my parents didn't know that I needed it, but my parents, I will say, were open to, like, basically doing anything that they could to try to not go down a similar path, mm-hmm. probably, that my siblings had, but that going to that counselor was so great, and I remember her saying, like, there's probably kind of, I guess now thinking about it, kind of how I try to interact with patients is, like, what if we think about, like, there could be other reasons for mm-hmm. this behavior? And I think it just became clear then, like, wow, there's really a lot that's gone on in my family. And there was a lot happening at that time, which was, like, my kind of, I think I started meeting with her when I was in early high school, but really in middle school, which I think is, like, one of the most challenging times in general. But there was a lot of family stuff happening at the time. So my sister had been, I guess both of my siblings had been kind of, like, in and out of living at home with me and okay. my parents because of their illnesses and also some of their drug use and just needing more support. But my sister had been living with us, and she was, if I was, like, 12 or 13 at the time, she was, like, in her mid to late 20s, and she had a very psychotic episode and followed me to school. And or, like, came and got me at school, and I still remember I was on the school bus, and she was talking about things being implanted in her head, and she needed to find find her high school teacher, her science teacher, because she had told her something about that, but it was in front of, like, an entire school bus of kids, mm-hmm. and also, like, I had never seen my sister that way, yeah. you know, I knew that there had been things that had happened in my earlier life with her, and that she'd been hospitalized, and that it was some sort of behavioral health episode and not a physical illness at the time. But I didn't really know. I mean, how do you explain that to someone that's, like, 5 or 8 yeah. years old? But certainly, like, having that, like, your peer relationships are so important at that time, and so it just felt very exposing, and I didn't know what to do with that. And
I mean, at that time, time your family does anything in public with you, it's embarrassing.
Right, everything, exactly.
So when it's something like that, it's even more so.
And you know, a lot of times too, like, people didn't even say anything. It's not like other kids were making fun of me mm-hmm. for this. It was just, like, all this stuff that I internalized, you know?
And that's 90% of what we end up talking about here with everybody that's been on so far. Like, a lot of it is just sheer internalization.
Yeah.
And then, again, we shut down due to self-stigma again.
Yeah. And also, like, maybe over time, me, like, trying to go back and explain why things happened, but I really do remember that as being a pivotal point and, like, just a hard age to cope with all that stuff, and it being the first time that it, like, interacted, like, those worlds kind of collided. Mm-hmm. And then my sister really had, like, a big up and down experience, but a lot of years of stability, and was, like, very engaged in treatment and had really good support from my parents and was really involved actually in NAMI back in Cleveland, and even participated in some of the trainings with police officers about how to handle mental health crises when the police are called and it's not actually, like, a threat of physical violence, mm-hmm. but more a mental health crisis. And, you know, just had, like, just gave a lot of positive things back, but that illness is so also can find its way back to, it's kind of like you constantly have to stay engaged, mm-hmm. and that's really hard too, especially when, you know, she didn't have a lot of financial resources, and sometimes when the switch flipped, you know, it flipped, like, really hard, and then drug use was involved too. And I think that is something it's totally reasonable, because it's like, you know, you're trying to find some way to feel better. I already said that mental illness is one of those things that is not like you have this symptom and we give you this medication yep. to fix that symptom. So you're looking for, like, something to cope, but often it just makes it so much worse.
Hearing you say that and hearing something that Carl says both all the time at the conversation cafes in the trainings and everything else that he does with Hope for the Day. But I mean, it goes back to the agency of the individual. So like, I mean, and that kind of then circles back to the first part of the conversation that we were having, where again, going to a healthcare provider that understands there's more to it than just a pure physical ailments, B, that it's not going to be a quick fix for some of that stuff, and then see the road can be very long for that. So setting people up for success on that long trip, and then making sure that you're giving them agency to walk down that road themselves and helping them along the way, but not either expecting them to be like just throwing meds at it, or just, you know, a classification and hospitalization or something like that. But it is something that needs to work back. And then there are ways to, unfortunately, get off track, and then it can be even more difficult to get back on track once you've been there and then fall off to kind of come full circle and see, oh, well, if it's just going to happen again, why even try? And that's where drug use comes in and all of that stuff. So it definitely is something to speak to a lot of the initial conversations around that, and breaking down some of the generally standard, not stigma, I'm trying to think of the right word, but the standard practices that we end up doing for that, where we end up having, like, we think it's only like one of a handful of things that we could ever do to kind of break out of a situation. But knowing that, like you said, there's a lot of things that your sister was doing, but then it kind of seemed to be an up and down, but it would things like everything would be going well, but then somehow something would creep back in, and no matter what, where you can't kind of push it all out. So it's always something that you have to be constantly working on as you're looking to get healthy.
I think you have to stay just constantly engaged with it, but I do think it lessens over time. Like the engagement becomes a little easier over time. Meaning, like, you know, I remember at a different event, someone asked something about like, well, is it ever going to get better? You know, like, am I ever not going to be obsessed with this? And at the time, I remember thinking, you know, like, yeah, because I feel like I can handle things a lot more easily now than I used to be able to. There used to be times in high school and college, and even immediately after college, where I remember being like depressed for long periods of time and not feeling like myself and feeling like I couldn't engage with other people and feeling like I was kind of watching myself from the outside for like weeks and months at a time, not wanting to get out of bed. And not to say that I feel great all the time now, but I certainly don't have those like long periods of that. But like, and maybe I haven't been going to counseling once a week, even though I'm sure I would benefit from it, but stay like keeping that pulse on it instead of like completely letting go of all engagement, you know, like, oh, I feel better, so I don't have to do anything anymore. And I talk about that experience with my sister a lot just because I had a lot of interaction with it, and I remember a lot of interaction with it, but I don't know really in detail what she was doing and how she was coping with it, because our age difference was just so big.
So big, yeah.
And we, even though we had like some overlap living at home, I mean, she moved out of the house when I was 5, and then I stayed there until I was 18, and maybe she lived with me for a total of like 2 years. And then otherwise it was just like some kind of touch points at the holidays and stuff. So, you know, she is my sibling, and she's someone that, you know, I have this shared experience with. We were raised by the same parents, but I don't know. And I don't think any of us know about anyone else, like what their experience is and how they're coping with it. And I have to trust that she was trying her best to stay engaged, but it also becomes very difficult. And I really do think that the drug use too is really hard to manage with it, because already the mental illness or brain illness is so poorly understood. We know it's got so much to do with chemicals and genetic factors and environmental factors, but then we, like, for as little as we know about that, then we also know like very little about exactly how drugs work as well, and then it's like two things like erupting with each other. So when I talk to some young people who are starting to experience some symptoms of depression or anxiety or like really rebellious behavior, I try to say, like, without, with like as little judgment as possible, just like, if you can just try to avoid drugs, because it's just one other thing.
It's an amplification of the unknown. It's, as you just said, there's a lot of unknowns in both, and when you put them together, it just adds to it exponentially.
Yeah.
And then so it's a case of you may already be behind the eight ball for some of what you're dealing with. Like you just said, it's mental, physical, environmental, a lot of things, but then adding something to it that's even more unknown can just start down a whole new path. Not even with that, but just, you know, drugs and alcohol as far as the type of addictive personalities that that are kind of known.
And then there's the stigma of the provider on top of that. So then, and I think unfortunately we all have it, you know, it's like if someone comes in and they're asking for help and there's stigma around drug use. So you ask the person, like, are you using any drugs? And they say no. And then at least, for example, in the emergency room, like anyone exhibiting any behavior that's a little bit questionable, or even people coming in saying, like, I need help. I don't feel safe with myself and my thoughts right now. It's like there's always this drive to, like, do a toxic screen on them and find out if they're not being honest about their drug use, but they're not being honest because of the reaction that other people have had. It's just this like cyclical thing. But I do feel like if people can avoid drug use, it just does preserve a little bit more of the...
You're just removing variables from the right. equation.
And then their provider will not have to... I mean, not that I think that that's how it should be, but it would be better for the provider to not have that lens on top of it and to deal with those symptoms and concerns that the patient has without that as like a complicating factor, or I'm just going to dismiss all your symptoms because you have cocaine in your system. Yeah. And
so like that obviously would lay on top of everything else. And so like it invalidates anything else we would talk about just because there's trace elements of drugs in the system.
Right, type thing. Exactly. And that's, it shouldn't be that way, but you know, that's how society has told us, you know, like people growing up in my age range, we were part of that, like, just say no campaign and this war on drugs. Yeah. And so anyone who's doing drugs is bad. Although it's funny how things like that can shift too, because now I feel like society thinks very differently of marijuana than we used to. Still, I'm still kind of scared about it because it, you know, it's another thing. We like the FDA can't research it because there's so much restriction, still federally illegal, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Exactly.
So we don't know how it impacts people in some senses, and sometimes still can cause a lot of problems with like pre-existing mental health challenges as well. So they're tricky things. There's not like perfect answers.
Kind of wrapping up on some of the topics that you had talked about in the Convo Cafe and kind of putting a button on that last thread, we lost your sister to suicide. In, was that January 2018?
Okay. Yeah. She, you know, to again credit her for like how engaged she was in healthcare and like wanting to get better, even though that previous year, so she died on January 9th. So really it was like 2017 was the kind of like bad year, yeah. I would say. And she had had a surgery early that year, like January 2017, and that required maybe change in medications. But she'd also become like really obsessed with, you know, trying to find causes for how she was feeling and just got like really obsessed. And there's like also all these like medical resources now on the internet that you can find, and you can get yourself really like hyped up on things. And I think that just got really overwhelming for her. And there was some drug use that year, but also like some real reaching out for help. And she ended up staying inpatient for almost, I think for 90 days inpatient, which is like unheard of, mm-hmm. I feel, you know.
Yeah, I mean, everything locally that is, at least on the news for a lot of the inpatient facilities in Chicago, most of it's like a week, 10 days,
yeah.
2 weeks. If
yeah,
that,
well, so. And I think so that says something for even like staying involuntarily. It's not like she was forced to mm-hmm. be there and she really wanted that help, but it was really, and I know, like, I didn't see her after she got out of the hospital, but my parents saw her just a couple days before she died, and they said she just looked so sad and so miserable. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that has, like, helped me, or at least been something that I have to think about, too. And we were talking about people having agency and autonomy, and that like she just really was suffering so much, and that, you know, at the point that she was and the choice that she made, not that I think it was a great choice and I wish she was still here, but that her suffering was just so immense at that time, and that it felt like even with all of the resources, she didn't have a way to cope mm-hmm. with it, you know? And that's, I guess, you know, when I'm thinking back to those statements of like, I need to change the healthcare system from the inside. It's like, how can I contribute to catching things earlier and helping people develop different coping strategies, or just listening, encouraging people who have an interest in doing research and psych research, and thinking about like, what are ways that we can treat differently, or how can we get real mental health parity, you know, because it's supposed to be that your insurance is supposed to cover mental mm-hmm. health the same as it does physical health, but it definitely doesn't. And the insurance system in general is just so outrageous, and like, you can't get a real price for anything, and prices are inflated, but certainly there's no mental health parity, and people, even with very good insurance, still cannot access behavioral health, which is really difficult. So how can I work on some of those barriers that maybe she faced that could help other people, and also just like talking openly with kids? Because I feel like a lot of this stuff really starts in like preteen years, mm-hmm. teenage years, and that's the time too where you can learn to self-advocate and ask for what you need. And I try to tell patients at that age, like, it will get better if you work at it, mm-hmm. it will get better, but also like can speak up, and it's okay to have emotions, and it's okay to need help with things, and if you address it at this age, it's going to be so much easier when you get older, because I feel like I had that experience.
Yeah, 100%. And a lot of it can be simplified, or there's a lot that can be prevented just with the saying that you just had, as far as it's okay to show emotion, whereas it, again, like you said, in that middle school time frame, like, that's where you don't want to show anything. You don't want to stick out. You don't want to be different in any way. But if you bottle everything up, it's just going to, you know, be a problem tenfold later on. So being able to show emotion and have that type of conversation and release an outlet is infinitely helpful compared to not having it at all. One of the other things you had mentioned in the Convo Cafe was the status of your brother at the time, as of November 2018. And then we aired in January, but we obviously didn't update or anything there. So was there anything?
Yeah. So my brother, who I guess maybe was like throughout my life a little bit less engaged with my parents, a little bit more independent, kind of like the touch points weren't as frequent as I was growing up, but I always really identified with him because he's super artistic, and I always liked that like creative artistic side and identified with that aspect of him. But it has been really hard over my adult life to stay in contact with him in a positive way, because he really struggles with, well, he is diagnosed with bipolar and really struggles with those kind of like grandiose thoughts and paranoia when he's not taking medication. And when he is taking medication, he does feel much better, but feels like part of him is kind of subdued, mm-hmm. unfortunately. And I think, you know, that's like a whole nother conversation. But he, last year around my sister's birthday, at least that's kind of like the thing that I think the timing that I've come to associate with this recent departure, mm-hmm. is that he got into a fight with his son, and it became not necessarily like physically threatening, but still to the point where like they needed to be separated. And then all of a sudden he left, and he told me he wasn't taking his medication, and there were just these like very infrequent calls and like missing persons calling to the police department in Florida, because he said he was in Florida, and saying like, there's a mental health emergency. And like, I was crying on the phone to these people saying like, we already lost one of my siblings this year. Like, mm-hmm. we need help. Again. And, you know, like, there's a limited amount that they can do, you know, and also like, what kind of stress am I putting on myself? And like, how productive is this? It turns out that all of that, there's not a lot that I can do. And he's in Seattle. In fact, he just texted me today an apology for something that he had said. You know, we've probably touched base maybe 4 times since November, and the last conversation he was so cruel, and it is hard to separate, like, that's my brother and I know he loves me and I love him and I want what's best for him, but, like, you can say these things in the moment. Mm-hmm. But I can appreciate that, like, he's not saying them in a way – he doesn't sound well, you know, but it's still so hurtful, you know?
100%.
So it is really hard with those family relationships or a relationship that was really important to you at one point when they're not able to help themselves and there's nothing that you can do seemingly to help them. And feeling frustrated with the system, which kind of feels like that's the only way that I can help is to be inside of it and try to treat people in a different way. But, you know, we talked about how, like, it's impossible to believe that my sister was impatient for 90 days. And then my brother is, like, you know, expressing clearly psychotic thoughts and making verbal threats and, like, goes to the hospital for a physical ailment because he got bit by a spider and it's infected or something. And despite saying all these things, because he's clearly, like, psychotic at the time, is just discharged from the emergency room. So there's, like, not a lot of help, you know? But he is okay, and he's staying in Seattle. And I think a lot of things – I think for a lot of people, like, structure is very important.
Absolutely.
Like, when you were talking about being a new parent, like, that is – there's no structure
at all.
Everything gets changed and babies don't have any regulation of, like, when you sleep and when you're awake and they don't have any responsibilities. I think having that is really important for everyone in my family. Maybe my brother more than anyone, you know, so he right now is fairly stable and living at a shelter that also gives him some work. And so I think that's, like, a good routine to be in. But I think there is something to be said, too. And I remember now back to that Conversations Cafe and to another event that I was at talking about, like, the value of someone objective and how, like, you really can't hear things from your own family or your own friends the same way you can hear them from someone who doesn't have, like, skin in the game. They don't know any of your other friends. They don't know how your wife is going to react or how your dad is going to react. They just are looking in from the outside. Not to say that, like, every outside opinion is valuable, but, you know, that it is something, like, having that. And I mentioned that I have kind of fallen out of my own, like, regular therapy. And that's because of this, well, probably because of, like, I need to prioritize it a little bit more, but also because of this job change and my schedule change. And it's just been hard. I think, like, the end goal is to have actually a way more regular schedule than I've ever had, but the transition hasn't really been seamless. Yeah. But I think, you know, when I start to feel, like, overwhelmed with thoughts or feeling kind of, like, down, not, I wouldn't say hopeless, but just down and, like, am I going to start feeling better? It is, like, well, I got to start taking these actions that I know work for me and that have slipped away a little bit, because I know when I don't have that regular touch point and someone objective to kind of reflect some of my emotions back, that I do feel way more overwhelmed with how everything is going.
It's definitely it's a tightrope to walk for do as I say, not as I do type stuff, where it's you can definitely, you know, succumb to caregiver fatigue or advocacy fatigue and some of that stuff. And knowing that you need to circle back and do some of this is going to be much better for you than something of kind of foregoing it all. So that's good. We'll start to wrap up here with a couple of questions, but you mentioned it a couple of times, but the paraphrasing one of your elements from the responses in the Combo Cafe, you were looking to, and you even mentioned it here, but I don't know if you're reading my sheet or not, but verbatim, but advocating for autonomy and agency in mental health and recovery. But what gives you hope in that endeavor to kind of keep coming back to it, to kind of contrast the caregiver fatigue and advocacy fatigue that we just mentioned? But what gives you hope in that effort for you to kind of keep going and keep fighting?
I think because I start seeing these these little changes that I feel like are the seeds of really big, meaningful change. You know, like that giving someone that opportunity to open up and to let go a little bit. And to actually, I saw something, I think it was on one of the platforms of social media from Hope for the Day, that said the healing starts when you're heard, you know, mm-hmm. like giving anyone that ability to start that healing and seeing the changes that it can have and seeing people open up and feel lighter is really, it's like a good promise to feel like, hey, you know, this could go a different way than it was otherwise mm-hmm. going to go. And I think, you know, I guess just like people having so much interest in this topic is really promising. And I think that was something that I mentioned at Conversations Cafe, the fact that there are people showing up to those
yep.
all the time because people want to talk about it. And if you share your vulnerabilities, sure enough, there's going to be someone who wants to talk about it because they feel that way too. And that it's okay to talk about it in public now that, you know, I work in a place where people have said, like, I needed to take time off because of anxiety, not like I needed to take time off because I was sick or like because, like, you know, like wanting to keep everything under wraps. Mm-hmm. Like, I see these little changes and I think like, oh, that person is better because of it, because they were able to express that. But I do, yeah, I think it's like a challenging question because weighing that with like also accepting when someone makes the choice to not pursue that path and to not move towards wellness or something, a wrench gets thrown in and they spiral a different direction. Like, it is hard as a provider, as a person, to watch that happen with other people and to accept, I feel like it's a 12-step motto, like, what are the things that I have control over? Mm-hmm. Like, allow me to, like, take control of those things that I do, but also accept the things that I don't have any control over. So it is like but one thing that I can control is like, how do I interact with people who are suffering and how do I frame things in a way that feels to me genuinely interested in being constructive.
So the two questions that we usually ask everybody, what is one thing you'd want someone to take away from your story?
I guess I taught in the fall semester and had a group of students that were going to be nurses. And I thought a lot about like, what do I feel like would be important for you to take from this experience? Because they were first semester nursing students and like, you don't have any skills at that point and you're scared of everything and everyone. And the thing that I thought was most important that I could give and just try to reiterate over and over again that I feel like I've said a lot is like, How do I approach this situation in a constructive way? Like, in a way that's going to help me feel better or help that person, you know, like if I'm going into this situation and I'm acting the same way that I've always acted and I'm upset that I'm not making any progress, like what's a way that I can like reframe this for being constructive? And that can apply to like things that I'm dealing with or someone's coping with in their own life, but also how they move into other situations or stressors, you know, like if I want the most positive outcome, like how can I reframe the way that I'm thinking?
No, it's a good one. That's a real good one because I think a lot of people are, unfortunately, myself included, get stuck in where they're at and they only think there's one way out of it. So to be able to take a step back or to the side and reframe that, generally with all of the healthcare discussion that we've had, like there are other ways that you can address it that might be a little bit more beneficial for you. So, I mean, thank you for the time. This has been a great discussion. I mean, it was nice to have a follow-up on some of the topics you had touched on when you were doing probably the largest panel that we've had for Conversations Cafe so far, and then get back here and, you know, have some one-on-one time to expand upon all of what you said, catch up on the, what's that been, 8, 9 months time.
Yeah.
And all of that stuff. So obviously a lot can happen at a time and a lot can change. So you've definitely been busy. So that's the not having a lot to miss there. So, I mean, thanks for the time. Is there anything else you wanted to cover before we wrap up?
No, I mean, it's just really good for me too. And I think that's what a lot of these, you know, these conversations are really good for for all of us, you know, just like I was saying, that everyone, like, there's so much interest and people want to participate and they want to be involved in this movement. You know, it's because it's like a mutually beneficial situation, you know? We all have our own self-interest in mind, too. Yep. And if something feels good and it feels good to be a part of something that's working towards positive change, you know, and it, like, you know, a lot of times it's not something that you want to do and you're not sure how it's going to go or, you know, but it, like, really does feel good in the end to connect with someone over moving forward in a positive way with mental health.
Yep, agreed. And there's another guest this season said that people are people. So we're always going to have people. So, you know, this hopefully is just the beginning of the movement to then bring people together and have the conversation and know that we need to be talking to each other. Because, again, jobs are going to change. Industry is going to change. Cars are different. TV's different. Technology, all that stuff. But people are all still going to be here. We're all still going to be people. So
yeah,
being able to talk about our experiences and just communicate and get to the just the connection, then that's really what it's all about. Well, thank you for the time.
Thank you. Thanks for my first podcast.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.